Welcome to Onk Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. Onk Live On Air is a podcast from Onk Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onk Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Ian Flynn, MD, PhD, Nicole Lamana, MD, Jennifer R. Brown, MD, PhD, and Constantine Tam, MD, MBBS, about the FDA approval of zanubrutinib in chronic lymphocytic leukemia and small lymphocytic lymphoma. Dr. Flynn is the Director of Lymphoma Research at Sarah Cannon Research Institute at Tennessee Oncology and the Director of the Sarah Cannon Transplant and Cellular Therapy Program at TriStar Centennial in Nashville. Dr. Lamana is an Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine in the Hematologic Malignancies Section of the Hematology Oncology Division at the Columbia University Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center in New York, New York. Dr. Brown is the Director of the Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Center at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and the Worthington and Margaret Collette Professor of Medicine in the field of Hematologic Oncology at Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Tam is the head of the lymphoma service and a clinical hematologist at Alfred Health, as well as a professor of hematology at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. On January 19, 2023, the FDA approved zanubrutinib for patients with CLL or SLL based on findings from the Phase 3 Sequoia trial in patients with treatment-naive disease and findings from the Phase 3 Alpine trial in patients with relapsed refractory disease. In Sequoia, treatment with zanubrutinib led to a median progression-free survival that was not reached versus 33.7 months with bendamustine and rituximab in a randomized cohort. The overall response rate was 94.6% with zanubrutinib versus 85.3% with bendamustine rituximab. In Alpine, the median progression-free survival was not reached in patients who received zanubrutinib versus 34.2 months with ibrutinib. The overall response rates with zanubrutinib and ibrutinib were 83.5% and 74.2% respectively. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Flynn discussed the significance of this approval and how it addresses previously unmet needs in CLL and SLL. Drs. Brown and Tam highlighted key efficacy and safety data from the Alpine and Sequoia trials, and Dr. Lamana explained the unique mechanism of action of zanubrutinib and where this agent may fit into the treatment paradigm. All right, so just to start off talking about the FDA approval of zanubrutinib in CLL and SLL, can you just describe the significance of this approval?
So the approval of zanubrutinib for CLL and SLL is important because it allows another option for patients in the frontline and relapse setting in CLL. And there are several other treatment options for patients, but the safety profile and the efficacy profile of this drug, I think, is important for patients with these diseases.
Can you just dive into the mechanism of action of zanubrutinib and how it compares with the mechanisms of action of other therapies in this space?
Zanubrutinib is one of the newer next generation small molecule inhibitors of BTK. So it forms a covalent bond with the cysteine residue in the BTK active site, so leading to the inhibition of BTK activity. Its mechanism is actually similar to some of the other covalent BTK inhibitors in the space, i.e. ibrutinib and acalabrutinib. However, it's more selective for BTK than ibrutinib. And so with this, hopefully less off-target effects, meaning less side effects that we see with ibrutinib, for example. And we now have head-to-head data, so we'll talk about that study, the Alpine study, but certainly more targeted for BTK, less off-side effects. And perhaps given that it was also designed to have in 24 hours, 100% BTK occupancy, there might also be differences with regards to efficacy. And again, there'll be a touch upon that when we talk about the head-to-head data.
Can you talk about some of the key efficacy data from both the Sequoia and Alpine trials?
In the relapse setting, Alpine was a head-to-head comparison of zanubrutinib to ibrutinib, and zanubrutinib significantly improved progression-free survival compared to ibrutinib by about 12% at 29 months follow-up. And this effect was even greater in the highest risk 17p deleted patients at 22%, which I think suggests that there's a real biologic phenomenon going on with zanubrutinib being more effective, perhaps related to the maintenance of drug levels throughout the dosing interval. So quite a robust data set for the use of zanubrutinib in CLL.
Sequoia is a frontline study comparing zanubrutinib and bendamustine rituximab. So really is a chemotherapy versus non-chemotherapy comparison. And not surprisingly, Sequoia really showed that the BTK inhibitor is a better treatment for frontline treatment of CLL than bendamustine rituximab. That's not a surprising result. We already knew from ibrutinib that the BTK inhibitors are better frontline treatment than all forms of chemotherapy. But what is interesting from the Sequoia study, though, are probably two points. So the first point is that the rate of atrial fibrillation is very low in Sequoia for zanubrutinib. It's 3%, which is exactly the same seen as bendamustine and rituximab. And I think that's important because most studies of ibrutinib versus a chemotherapy drug have shown a higher rate of atrial fibrillation for ibrutinib, which is, you know, one of the more limiting treatment toxicities of ibrutinib. The second point that's interesting about Sequoia is that Sequoia actually had a number of 17 PD leader patients. And these are patients that were not assigned to randomization between zanubrutinib and bendamustine rituximab. They were just prescribed zanubrutinib as a non-randomized arm. And if you actually look at those patients with the poor prognosis 17 PD lesion, which were treated for frontline zanubrutinib without randomization, and you compare the progression-free survival of that arm with those patients without 17 P, so these are standard patients treated on the randomized zanubrutinib arm. So this is zanubrutinib versus zanubrutinib, a 17P versus non-17P. Basically, the progression-free survival, at least at the current follow-up, overlaps. And I think that's a really important data point to show that the potent BTK inhibitors such as zanubrutinib and to a lesser extent ibrutinib has really largely neutralized the adverse risk of 17P deletion CLL, at least in the front line. So I think that's a really encouraging outcome to our patients. I still remember, you know, if we go back 7-8 years ago, when a patient has a 17P CLL diagnosed at frontline, it's almost a death sentence for that patient. You know, FCR doesn't work in these patients and there were very few options. And it's really, you know, shows the progress that we've made that we have a drug now that gives those patients at least a short-term disease control. We need longer follow-up that is at least as good as those patients without 17P deletion.
Can you just describe a little bit more about what the safety profile looks like for this agent and if there are any patients in whom you would hesitate to use this agent because of adverse effects?
So BTK inhibitors in general are known for their cardiac side effects, particularly atrial fibrillation, also ventricular arrhythmias and risk of sudden death. And so zanubrutinib particularly shown in having a safer cardiac profile compared to ibrutinib in the Alpine study. The rate of AFib at 29 months was only 5% for zanubrutinib versus 13% for ibrutinib. There was only one person who stopped for a cardiac serious adverse event, and there were no cardiac deaths with zanubrutinib versus 6 with ibrutinib. So given this, I have specifically chosen to use zanubrutinib in patients with significant cardiac disease where I needed to use a BTK inhibitor. I usually might not use a BTK inhibitor first in those patients, but nonetheless, sometimes you come around to needing to use it. And zanubrutinib has been a well-tolerated choice in my experience in that setting. One of the other side effects of BTK inhibitors is hypertension. And that was actually at about the same level with zanubrutinib and ibrutinib. It tends to accumulate over time. So at 29 months was about 22% of the patients. So that's something one always has to watch out for, but is generally manageable. Bleeding is another key side effect. And in my experience, I think the bleeding rates are fairly similar across the covalent BTK inhibitors, maybe a bit better for acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, but you still need to be careful when combining even zanubrutinib with anticoagulation. Patients may get bruising and there's also a risk of more significant bleeding. So one needs to be careful about that. That being said, I suppose the only patients who I might not use BTK inhibitors in now are those who are on warfarin and have to stay on warfarin. Normally, if someone's on warfarin, we'll just change them to an oral anticoagulant like apixaban and then still go ahead with the BTK inhibitor. But if there are patients, for example, with valves or issues where they have to stay on warfarin, then I might hesitate.
There are probably two main disadvantages of zanubrutinib. The first one is it's twice a day, whereas ibrutinib is once a day. So it is slightly less convenient to use. is twice a day because we believe that that was the dosage that gives you the best maintenance of drug levels. It actually can be used once a day, and the license in most countries actually allow the physician to use it once a day. We have shown from the very first study that twice a day dosing does give you better BDK inhibition in lymph nodes. But for the patient who struggle with twice a day, once a day is possible. But that is one disadvantage, is, you know, is more frequent dosing. The other disadvantage is potentially an increased risk of neutropenia. The rate of grade 3 to 4 neutropenia is higher with zanubrutinib compared to ibrutinib, but that's the only toxicity that is disadvantageous for zanubrutinib. And that neutropenia does not translate to increased infections. Across every clinical trial that's ever compared the two drugs, the rate of infection is either the same or favor zanubrutinib. In my practice, the neutropenia is really not dose limiting. My patients who get neutropenia, it can be either managed with a slight dose reduction or with a short-term support with, let's say, G-CSF given on a weekly or twice-weekly basis. And in my experience, most of those neutropenia resolve after a few weeks. So really, it's a safety signal to be aware of, but it doesn't make me, for example, you know, if I have a patient who is neutropenic at baseline, it doesn't stop me from choosing zanubrutinib as the preferred drug, because I do know that any neutropenia that I get on drug is actually quite easily managed.
How does this agent fulfill some previously unmet needs, specifically in the CLL population?
So I think one of the biggest challenges in patients with CLL and previously untreated CLL is finding an agent that they can use, that they can take on a daily basis and not suffer adverse events. We have a number of great treatment options in the frontline setting for patients with CLL, such as ibrutinib, such as acalabrutinib, such as venetoclax. These are all important treatment options for patients. But when we think about zanubrutinib, it is a next generation BTK inhibitor. And by that, I mean it has less off-target kinase inhibition. And it's this off-target kinase inhibition that we see with ibrutinib that causes the adverse events associated with it. And so having a cleaner drug that someone can stay on therapy longer is an important option for patients with CLL and other related lymphomas.
How do you see this agent fitting into the overall treatment landscape for patients with frontline or relapsed refractory CLL?
I think that we're going to see an increasing usage of zanubrutinib, not only as monotherapy, but from some of these combination studies, such as zanubrutinib and venetoclax. I think you're going to see a lot more of that data as well from Sequoia with the ARMD cohort. And so I think it's going to be an exciting time to see more longer term follow-up in these studies, but also in the combination studies in zanubrutinib. So certainly increasing the frequency of its usage, both in the frontline and relapse setting.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.